Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Kelsey Herman. Today's guest is Mike Sexton, and he's going to come talk to us today about spyware. Mike Sexton is the Senior Policy Advisor for Cyber and AI at Third Way's National Security Program. He was named to the inaugural 40 Under 40 cohort by the Middle East Policy Council at the age of 29 and is a member of Foreign Policy for America and the OODA Network. He is the lead editor of Cyber War and Cyber Peace, an anthology of expert essays on cyber conflict in the Middle East. He has guest lectured or led discussions at the Palestinian American Chamber of Commerce, Northwestern University Medill School of Journalism, and the Harvard Arab Alumni Association. He is proficient in Arabic, Hebrew, and Spanish. Mike holds an MA in Security Studies from here at Georgetown, with a concentration in Technology and Security, and a BA in Mathematics with a minor in Near Eastern Languages and Civilization from University of Chicago. I wanted to do an episode on spyware because I think it's made some pretty significant headlines in the last few years. You might have heard of something called Pegasus, and we're going to get into that in the episode. It's really important to realize that when you have the onset of something like encryption, you're going to have some technologies that counter those capabilities. And in this case, we're seeing spyware. And it can be a really fuzzy line to walk between protecting the privacy of individuals and pursuing safety and security. So hopefully this conversation helps us dig into these issues a little bit more. And with that, let's go ahead and get started. Hi, Mike. Thank you again for taking the time to join us on the podcast.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's jump right in. My first question is kind of to just level set. So what is spyware? Can you give us kind of like an overview of the applications? Why do we care about this technology?
Yeah, in the earlier days of the internet, I think spyware was a more broad and kind of ambiguous term that could include things like browser extensions that are, you know, supposed to give you some added benefit, but actually track your browsing habits, things like that. In the past, I'd say about 10 years, spyware has kind of developed a more strict definition as specifically hacking technology that remotely penetrates, in particular, a smartphone, but it could also be a computer that penetrates the device remotely to collect intelligence. You know, is generally able to persist covertly without revealing itself. It may include being able to take control of the device, interfere with it in some way, but the primary defining characteristics are a program that's intended really to be used by police, intelligence, perhaps militaries to gain intelligence from a smartphone or other computing device remotely.
So you sort of touched on this in your answer, but who are we seeing use this technology? What's the landscape look like?
So it's a little bit hard to say with absolute certainty because this is really a kind of field where you know what you know and you don't know what you don't know. So there could be companies that sell this kind of technology successfully to the United States, other Five Eyes countries. It's possible there are companies that sell this that are successful, that are held to stricter human rights standards, and therefore they just are not in the press. One example of a company like this is called Graphite. It is funded by an American venture capital firm called Battery Ventures. Former Israeli President Ehud Barak, I believe, is on the board. So as far as like spyware outfits go, this is one of the more legit ones. It has been reported that they sell their technology to the Drug Enforcement Agency, which would imply that it meets the Biden administration standards, that it will not buy this technology if the tool is also being used to abuse human rights. So as far as we can tell, it seems that Graphite holds itself to these human rights standards and at least deals with one United States government agency. My suspicion is there would probably be more, but we only know what we know. Much more publicized is NSO Group, another spyware firm that is much less scrupulous. I mean, has just very few, very little in the way of standards as far as the human rights records of the customers they're willing to sell to.
So we've touched on it a little bit again, but what are kind of the inherent risks to this technology? I mean, it's a little scary to think that anything that you're doing on your phone can be observed and intelligence can be gathered. So who suffers from this and who maybe benefits more so?
Yeah, the concern is, pretty obvious if you look at the cases of abuse. Most autocratic Arab governments like Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates have been caught using these tools to surveil journalists or political dissidents, sometimes people in foreign countries and not just their own. So, you know, the concern is that this technology could be, I think, very powerful for counterterrorism, you know, child sexual exploitation, other really serious crimes where encryption presents a very pretty much insurmountable threat to gathering evidence. If spyware were limited to those extreme cases, I think it could be a useful tool in the government's hands. But very often we have seen documented that it's being used against people like associates of Jamal Khashoggi, for example. So that is really the threat and the risk.
And we've heard from the White House and Congress, they've sort of both tackled this issue. And they're concerned that this is a national security threat to American citizens. So how is that the case?
Even though when we speak about spyware, we're oftentimes talking about Pegasus, just because Pegasus NSO Group spyware is far and away the most thoroughly documented. It's been found in so many countries. And that does include United States citizens, even though NSO Group has publicly made statements where they have said, and I believe this is correct, that Pegasus cannot infect American phone numbers. That is phone numbers that start with the country code plus one. NSO Group has said that they cannot target American citizens, but that's obviously, I think, conflating the latter with the former. Plenty of American citizens have non-American phone numbers, and those that there have been Americans with non-American phone numbers who have been targeted. One example is a journalist in El Salvador named Roman Gressier, who worked for a newspaper there called El Faro. El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele is very colorful dictator and is very much a techno autocrat. He's very into Bitcoin. He's very into spyware. He's very into mass arrests. And I believe he just won 54 out of 60 seats in an election. So you can independently determine the validity of that election. Nayib Bukele has used Pegasus spyware against nearly all the journalists at El Faro, including at least this one American citizen. There have been others. There have been American residents, Khashoggi's associates. Khashoggi himself was a United States resident in Virginia at the time that he was assassinated. So, you know, it absolutely does impact Americans in that direct sense, but in an indirect sense as well, the poorly regulated spyware market creates an economic incentive. If I am an independent vulnerability researcher, if I'm just a private guy who knows how to hack things and I want to make money finding my vulnerabilities, the United States would ideally, I think, incentivize me to reveal those vulnerabilities to Apple or Google or whoever is the smartphone provider so they can patch it and make it safer, because that's better for all Americans. It makes all Americans and all users of those smartphones less safe if I sell these vulnerabilities to companies like NSO Group so they can exploit them. That's like just a huge, huge thing, is that the privatized vulnerability, software vulnerability market is like ethically a moral landmine. we as a society need to get a better handle over that and what it implies for our security on an individual and a societal level.
And that touches off perfectly my next question. How are we regulating this now, if at all? What can we do better?
So what the Biden administration has done, and it's really impressive, and they deserve a lot of credit for going further than a lot of our EU allies, actually, in regulating spyware. The Biden administration has issued a couple of executive orders on this, and the primary big rule is saying we will buy spyware, but we will not buy it for operational use if we know that it is also being used to abuse human rights. So there's an exception to that. The government will still buy Pegasus or other human rights abusing spyware to test it, to see how it works, to figure out how to defend against it themselves. So they do reserve that. It's important for people if they find, the FBI still does procure Pegasus to understand, is it under that loophole? But outside of that loophole, the United States will only do business with these ethical spyware makers. I want to, caveat that to some people, no form of spyware is ethical. To me, I think that in certain cases, I think this Georgetown Security Studies program might have some people who also believe that sometimes intelligence requires, in this case, spyware, which causes no physical harm to anybody. I think its use is justified in certain cases. By setting this rule that will only deal with the ethical companies, we essentially screw with the entire profit model of the industry. So if you are NSO group, putting yourself in NSO group's shoes, your financial strategy kind of initially from your starting is to get as many clients as you can, so that way you get more revenue and you can develop more tools and sell to more people, right? That obviously doesn't work very well if you're in, like, if your intention at least is to sell to countries like the United States or United Kingdom that want to make sure that you're not selling to Sudan. By creating that, there's now this new incentive to be selective. And the news about abuses from NSO Group have markedly gone down since this. There have been lots of reports about their financial troubles, about massive layoffs and restructurings. It kind of seems like to me, and this is speculation, that where NSO Group is going to probably land is with some rule that they can only sell to the United States and European Union. And they'll probably end up selecting some kind of straggler states like Hungary, Eastern European countries. Greece, for example, has abused spyware a lot. Perhaps limiting the market to more within the international legal system type of countries, limiting their revenue and also limiting the spread of their abuses.
So the U.S. is definitely, you mentioned, kind of taking this leadership role in regulating this technology, but is anyone doing anything else, or is it just completely like blank slate everywhere else besides the U.S.?
I mean, it's not been nothing in the EU. There have been many investigations by the European Parliament into abuses in Greece, in Poland, but primarily what I've seen from the EU have been investigations and reports rather than actual regulation. And I'm still worried a bit about the regulation on the American side, because it's been executive orders, and it hasn't been laws. And, here at Third Wave, talk to people in Congress and their staffers, and I think there's a recognition that we want to make sure that these Biden administration rules could survive into a Trump administration. Or any Republican administration. There's just a kind of question about exactly statutorily how Congress would replicate, a measure that's already been taken. That's something concerning. It's also a lot of the onus is on just the Israeli government. When Netanyahu left office briefly and handed over the reins to Naftali Bennett, the Israeli government changed its tune with spyware companies significantly. Previously, it had been very much carte blanche, sell to whomever. In fact, I've heard reports and at least and rumors that the Israeli government would even subsidize NSO Group to sell to countries where it would not be profitable, where it would not be ethical, but where the Israeli government sees a particular diplomatic value in selling to that country. That was primarily a Netanyahu administration, Trump administration kind of policy of human rights negligence. Things changed when Biden got into office and started putting pressure on the Israeli government to knock this off. Things really changed when Naftali Bennett became prime minister. The list of countries that spyware companies in Israel can sell to was reduced dramatically. And again, it's you don't know what you don't know. I don't know exactly what the market cap of Israeli spyware companies have looked like since then, their total payroll or something. And I don't have a good sense of exactly, since Netanyahu has come back, to what degree that has been loosened. But at least as far as I can tell, I have not seen any rolling back of that tightening. I'm very concerned about it in the future, but progress has been made on the part of both the American and the Israeli governments on this issue.
So we've definitely touched on how nation states are using these tools. Are we seeing individuals or criminal groups or even terrorists pick these up? Maybe not as nearly as sophisticated, but sort of replicating this technology?
It's a really good question. I have not seen any cases of spyware tools like Pegasus being used by individuals. There are cases where the sales are so kind of convoluted, because oftentimes NSO Group is going to be selling to a country that, like, Israel does not have diplomatic relations with. So it'll be NSO Group gives the software to a cutout company, and the cutout company gives it to another cutout company in the country. So the way this ends up working is made up companies giving this technology to each other. Which sometimes turns out in places like sub-Saharan Africa being registered to a shack at the president's brother's like backyard or something. Like, it gets very sketchy sometimes. Mexico's intelligence services have been really rampant abusers of spyware, like to the point that it would not surprise me if there were cases of Mexican intelligence corruptly using spyware for like an individual's interests. In particular, there were a group of medical researchers who were pushing in Mexico for tighter regulations on food, for better food labels with high sugar content. And these medical researchers were literally just pushing for better nutrition labels. Several of them got hacked by Mexican intelligence with Pegasus. And again, like, I can't stress enough that, like, the two cases where we're saying we want to see these are counterterrorism and child sexual exploitation, not campaigning for better nutrition labels. If you want, like, cinnamon buns to have a nutrition label on the front that says how much sugar there are, you shouldn't be getting hacked with Pegasus. So, like, in those sorts of cases, is that Mexican intelligence going after those people, or is it like a bakery that sells baked goods? Because that seems just more plausible to me. I'm speculating there, but there have absolutely been some really insane cases where spyware is used against people where it just makes zero sense whatsoever.
Wow, yeah. Not the bakers of Mexico engaging with the intelligence agencies. So we've talked a little bit about the executive orders that the Biden administration has put out. Are we putting ourselves at a disadvantage by sort of limiting our use of these tools? I mean, we're still using them, obviously, and in these narrow use cases that you've sort of mentioned. But are we handicapping ourselves when our adversaries and even our allies are using these?
I love this question, because this is originally what got me interested in SSP was over 10 years ago, when I was applying to SSP now, was when encryption became this really widespread thing on all of our smartphones after, you know, the San Bernardino shooting. The FBI wanted to get into the shooter's iPhone, and Apple said, no, we're not going to help you break into our iPhone because that would undermine the security of all of our iPhones. And I could, witnessing this, I could understand Apple's argument and why it made absolute technical sense, but I could also understand the political position of the US government, a lot of members of Congress, and even Barack Obama. at the time, but he was president of the United States at the time, and saying that Apple should unlock the phone. People really, I think, forget how hard the political tide was against Apple during the San Bernardino investigation. So what I think is, I really do sympathize with the law enforcement position in that case, and I want them to have the tools to get into that iPhone, not just that iPhone, but any iPhone if there is a terrorist attack. I understand the anxiety of members of Congress who say, you know, this encryption thing, totally new. It just came around when these guys are in their 70s, these senators that are so ticked off about it. So it's understandable that they say, like, oh, encryption is a problem, we have to get rid of it. I think that's absolutely backwards. A huge mistake. Encryption is a genie you can't put back in the bottle. Most of the, like, security software is open source, so all you're going to do is make it harder for law-abiding Americans to defend themselves without actually eliminating the security that people who want it will be able to still get it. The best way to spread the circle to me is to have a very small but reliable spyware sector where we recognize there's strict limits on how this gets used. You know, it should be something really involved, like the FISA courts, before you get a spyware warrant approved. But I think that should exist. I don't, because I do think the United States would, absolutely, you're correct, be handicapping ourselves if we were to say not only that we support encryption everywhere, which we should, but also that we're not going to try to keep any technology to get past. So yeah, I mean, I think the Biden administration has threaded the needle just right by saying we are still going to buy this, we're not banning it, but we're going to impose these really strict standards on when we do and when we use it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And we're already, like you mentioned, we're seeing kind of the windfall of that impacting the entire industry, probably for the better. Where do you see this going in the future? Do you see this technology being proliferated, or do you see maybe something's going to happen that's really terrible, that where this technology was involved and it's now going to be a taboo and we're kind of going to rethink how we use this in general?
Yeah, I'm honestly not entirely sure, because the encryption trend to me seems to have kind of like hit its kind of ending point. We have full disk encryption now, enabled by default on practically all of our smartphones. The trend I see is less of our data being behind that encryption fortress, and more of our data, as AI becomes more ubiquitous, we are giving more of our data to various AIs. And I'm including myself in this very much. ChatGPT, Gemini, Pi, all of these different AI chatbots know a lot about me right now. And encryption isn't protecting me from it. Where it seems like it's going to me is just an open question of the privacy of these huge AI systems, that's going to be even harder to untangle than the social media privacy debates that we have also not been able to satisfactorily resolve for 10 years. That's kind of the direction it seems like it's going to me, I think spyware will still be necessary in the same way in 10 years, but I think it may be less necessary. That's just my speculation.
Thank you again, Mike, for your time. We really appreciated having you on the podcast.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you so much.
As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, the U.S. government, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review on social media to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org. Thank you to all of our listeners. This is the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review.